This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, June 2020. This test is in four parts, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about forms of transport. Read the list of vehicles below, then listen to the extracts. For each question, 1 to 5, identify which form of transport, A to H, is being described by each speaker, by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box, and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all forms of transport are described, and each may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Speaker 1.
This is probably the most energy-efficient form of transport. It is also eco-friendly as it does not rely on any type of fuel. It can be used for commuting to work, school, university, as well as for family excursions and trips. This form of transport is becoming increasingly popular in many cities, in an attempt to decrease air pollution.
Speaker 2.
This form of transport is having a comeback in cities that discarded it many years ago. Running on electricity and not on fossil fuel, it does not add to the city's air pollution levels. It is a fast way to commute as it runs on tracks which are in the road. As it always has a right of way, it avoids traffic jams.
Speaker 3.
If you commute from your hometown to the centre of the city in which you work or study, this might be your preferred form of transport. It is a convenient way to travel as you can read, do your homework, or even make use of your mobile phone and Wi-Fi while you are being taken to your destination. It takes hundreds of passengers at a time.
Speaker 4. It is highly unlikely that most of us will ever use this form of transport for everyday travel. However, it is important for business people who might need to travel long distances within their own country or abroad. It is also a popular option for families going on holiday who want to get to their destination as quickly as possible. Speaker 5.
Arguably, this is the most popular means of travelling to or from work or for pleasure. It is mainly powered by either diesel or petrol. Its major drawback is that it contributes to air and noise pollution in both cities and countryside. On the plus side, people can be flexible because they do not have to stick to a timetable.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
This is probably the most energy-efficient form of transport. It is also eco-friendly as it does not rely on any type of fuel. It can be used for commuting to work, school, university, as well as for family excursions and trips. This form of transport is becoming increasingly popular in many cities in an attempt to decrease air pollution.
Speaker 2.
This form of transport is having a comeback in cities that discarded it many years ago. Running on electricity and not on fossil fuel, it does not add to the city's air pollution levels. It is a fast way to commute as it runs on tracks which are in the road. As it always has a right of way, it avoids traffic jams.
Speaker 3.
If you commute from your hometown to the centre of the city in which you work or study, this might be your preferred form of transport. It is a convenient way to travel as you can read, do your homework, or even make use of your mobile phone and Wi-Fi while you are being taken to your destination. It takes hundreds of passengers at a time.
Speaker 4. It is highly unlikely that most of us will ever use this form of transport for everyday travel. However, it is important for business people who might need to travel long distances within their own country or abroad. It is also a popular option for families going on holiday who want to get to their destination as quickly as possible. Speaker 5.
Arguably, this is the most popular means of travelling to or from work or for pleasure. It is mainly powered by either diesel or petrol. Its major drawback is that it contributes to air and noise pollution in both cities and countryside. On the plus side, people can be flexible because they do not have to stick to a timetable.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear an extract from a podcast about a very popular car. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
The German motor car company Volkswagen has decided to end the production of its most famous car. Over the years, it has sold over 20 million of them. The car known as the Beetle, because of its rounded body, will no longer be made after July 2020. The Beetle was introduced in Germany in 1938. And called the Volkswagen, which means the people's car. It could seat 2 adults, 2 children, take all their luggage, and travel up to 120 kilometres per hour. The Beetle was specially designed to travel on the newly built German motorways, allowing people to enjoy travel not only to work, but also to holiday destinations. It was a simple car, and it was made affordable for many, thanks to a special savings scheme. In 1949, it was introduced to the USA, and an American production plant set up. For over 30 years, the Beetle proved to be very popular. Unfortunately, more modern and stylish cars appeared, and gradually the funny-shaped car lost its popularity, and the Americans stopped making it. They shut down the factory and moved production to Mexico. It was in Puebla that the last of the original Beetles was produced, in 2003. Both the German and American companies tried to revive the Beetle, giving it a more modern shape, but it was not a success. It was then decided that none will be produced after 2020. There are no definite plans to introduce an electric version, although the company do not rule that out. If customers are interested and there's a demand for it, then who knows? There may be a Beetle for the next generation of motorists. The little car has an enormous number of faithful fans worldwide. Every year, a rally is held, and Worldwide Beetle Day is celebrated by enthusiasts, who get together from all over the world to commemorate the iconic German car model.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
The German motor car company Volkswagen has decided to end the production of its most famous car. Over the years, it has sold over 20 million of them. The car known as the Beetle, because of its rounded body, will no longer be made after July 2020. The Beetle was introduced in Germany in 1938 and called the Volkswagen, which means the people's car. It could seat two adults, two children, take all their luggage, and travel up to 120 kilometres per hour. The Beetle was specially designed to travel on the newly built German motorways, allowing people to enjoy travel not only to work, but also to holiday destinations. It was a simple car, and it was made affordable for many, thanks to a special savings scheme. In 1949, it was introduced to the USA, and an American production plant set up. For over 30 years, the Beetle proved to be very popular. Unfortunately, more modern and stylish cars appeared, and gradually the funny-shaped car lost its popularity, and the Americans stopped making it. They shut down the factory and moved production to Mexico. It was in Puebla that the last of the original Beetles was produced, in 2003. Both the German and American companies tried to revive the Beetle, giving it a more modern shape, but it was not a success. It was then decided that none will be produced after 2020. There are no definite plans to introduce an electric version, although the company do not rule that out. If customers are interested, and there's a demand for it, then who knows? There may be a Beetle for the next generation of motorists. The little car has an enormous number of faithful fans worldwide. Every year, a rally is held, and Worldwide Beetle Day is celebrated by enthusiasts, who get together from all over the world to commemorate the iconic German car model.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear an extract from an educational program about reading for all the family. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hello, I'm Sue Green, a lecturer in primary education and co-creator of an online book club for young readers. My talk today is on how the whole family can get into reading. We're a nation of screen lovers, and in our modern, fast-paced world, who can blame us? Technology provides a bite-sized entertainment fix instantly, fitting perfectly into our busy lives. So, losing ourselves in the world of a book is increasingly hard to do, but it's a pleasure we are denying ourselves. With approximately 60% of preschool children not being read to, it is time to rediscover the joys and benefits of reading for all the family. There are simple ways to welcome books back into your life or introduce children to the happiness a book can bring. When your child shows an interest in a book, seize that moment. Bedtime stories are an important routine. Creating a reading corner with cushions and a favorite toy can be fun for some children. It is also a good idea to have books in most rooms in the house so they can read whenever they fancy it. It's key that reading sessions are fun and the right length. 10 minutes might be plenty for an active preschooler. Remember, reading isn't just about traditional books. It's often a good idea to set apart the school books they have to read as homework and the books they want to read at home, like amusing poetry, picture books, or comics. Your local library is the easiest and best source of a wide selection of children's books. Give children the freedom to choose the books that catch their attention. If you struggle to get your teenager to pick up a book, identify topics that interest them, a news story or a favourite sport, and then find newspaper articles in print and online to share with them. Looking at a subject in different ways will help improve their critical thinking. Teen fiction is great, and if they enjoy a series, ask your librarian for suggestions along a similar vein. Librarians have a wealth of knowledge, so make use of them. Books loved by teenagers and adults alike are great for starting up a conversation once you've both read them. You could do worse than refresh your memory of the exam text your child is studying and be prepared to be surprised and inspired. Plan a trip to a local book festival. Hearing a favourite author, or somebody new, talk about their creations can be very inspiring. It is easy to find dates and venues for festivals online. Routines aren't just for children. Many of us are so busy making sure everything else is on track that we forget to make time for ourselves. Try swapping your bedtime scrolling for a chapter of a good book. Switch off the TV and get some reading time instead. If the thought of starting a new novel is daunting, you can always start with a short story. Not sure where to start? Find a local book club that meets monthly, giving you a reading target. If a book isn't working, don't be afraid to say so and move on. Life's too short to stick with something you're not enjoying. The book club is not for you? Create an online book club account. You can add books that you've read and enjoyed to your profile, and the site will come up with suggestions tailored to your taste. I hope these few practical tips and ideas will inspire you and your family to fall in love with reading, perhaps for the first time, or possibly again.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello, I'm Sue Green, a lecturer in primary education and co-creator of an online book club for young readers. My talk today is on how the whole family can get into reading. We're a nation of screen lovers, and in our modern, fast-paced world, who can blame us? Technology provides a bite-sized entertainment fix instantly, fitting perfectly into our busy lives. So, losing ourselves in the world of a book is increasingly hard to do, but it's a pleasure we are denying ourselves. With approximately 60% of preschool children not being read to, it is time to rediscover the joys and benefits of reading for all the family. There are simple ways to welcome books back into your life or introduce children to the happiness a book can bring. When your child shows an interest in a book, seize that moment. Bedtime stories are an important routine. Creating a reading corner with cushions and a favourite toy can be fun for some children. It is also a good idea to have books in most rooms in the house so they can read whenever they fancy it. It's key that reading sessions are fun and the right length. 10 minutes might be plenty for an active preschooler. Remember, reading isn't just about traditional books. It's often a good idea to set apart the school books they have to read as homework and the books they want to read at home, like amusing poetry, picture books, or comics. Your local library is the easiest and best source of a wide selection of children's books. Give children the freedom to choose the books that catch their attention. If you struggle to get your teenager to pick up a book, identify topics that interest them, a news story or a favourite sport, and then find newspaper articles in print and online to share with them. Looking at a subject in different ways will help improve their critical thinking. Teen fiction is great, and if they enjoy a series, ask your librarian for suggestions along a similar vein. Librarians have a wealth of knowledge, so make use of them. Books loved by teenagers and adults alike are great for starting up a conversation once you've both read them. You could do worse than refresh your memory of the exam texts your child is studying and be prepared to be surprised and inspired. Plan a trip to a local book festival. Hearing a favourite author, or somebody new, talk about their creations can be very inspiring. It is easy to find dates and venues for festivals online. Routines aren't just for children. Many of us are so busy making sure everything else is on track that we forget to make time for ourselves. Try swapping your bedtime scrolling for a chapter of a good book. Switch off the TV and get some reading time instead. If the thought of starting a new novel is daunting, you can always start with a short story. Not sure where to start? Find a local book club that meets monthly, giving you a reading target. If a book isn't working, don't be afraid to say so and move on. Life's too short to stick with something you're not enjoying. The book club is not for you? Create an online book club account. You can add books that you've read and enjoyed to your profile, and the site will come up with suggestions tailored to your taste. I hope these few practical tips and ideas will inspire you and your family to fall in love with reading, perhaps for the first time, or possibly again.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an interview with an artist who has created a comic version of a well-known novel. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box, and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good evening. Henry Jones here, welcoming you to our latest edition of the arts radio magazine, Front Row. Tonight, we are going to discuss an unusual event. Two supposedly conflicting art forms joining forces to create something new and exciting. I'm talking about a comic book remake of To Kill a Mockingbird. Since its publication in 1960, Harper Lee's novel has been turned into a stage play, which is performed every year in Lee's hometown, a musical, and most famously an Oscar-winning film in 1962. However, no one thought of adapting the multi-award-winning novel into a comic book until now. A graphic or comic book adaptation is about to be released, and the artist chosen and approved of by Harper Lee's family is a young British illustrator, Fred Foreman. He studied politics and philosophy at Sussex University, where, hoping to earn extra money for his studies, he painted portraits and taught art. He became interested in graphic art and chose to become an illustrator and painter. He has not looked back. Congratulations, Fred. It must have been a mammoth task to draw and adapt the book.
Thanks, Henry. You have no idea how excited I was when I was approached amid a spy novel atmosphere of secrecy to adapt the great work in 2016. I can tell you, it was pretty daunting. To Kill a Mockingbird is considered more than a novel. It's a cultural event. I never thought it would be possible. However, I went on a 10-day trip to Monroeville, Lee's hometown, on which she based the fictional make-home of the book, and saw where she lived. The Lee family were very keen on the idea of a graphic novel, and convinced me that a meaningful adaptation was possible.
You will agree, as will many of our listeners, that To Kill a Mockingbird has been such an important book to us for more than half a century, and the novel has been credited with awakening thousands of teenagers to the rewards of literature. It is amazing to think that this classic portrayal of injustice and innocence in America's Deep South is being brought to a new generation in the form of a graphic novel.
That's right. So instead of devouring Harper Lee's wonderful prose, readers can follow the tale of Scout, Jem, Boo Radley, and Atticus Finch through 260 pages of colourful cartoons and speech bubbles. Although I am aware that this will be fun to read, I have a clear message for all young readers. It's absolutely no substitute for the original.
So you're saying that the new graphic version should not be seen by young readers as a lightweight alternative to reading the full text?
Absolutely not. I read it at school and then at university as part of my degree course. To try and do a graphic or comic adaptation of something solely to make it easier to read is doing a disservice to the original novel. It also does the same to the graphic novel because, in a way, it's treating the comic book as a more childish version. This should be read as well as, not instead of. Pretty much the same way as up until now, you would watch the film as an introduction to the book.
You know, despite the reservations of many in the literary establishment, graphic novels are becoming ever more mainstream. Comic book versions of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Emma have been produced and well received, which proves the medium is growing in popularity with increasing numbers of readers. However, To Kill a Mockingbird must have presented particular challenges.
You're right. There are some very somber and solemn episodes in the book, and you have to accept that. But in so many other ways, it's very easy to read. Bits of it are light and funny. Even the sad parts are seen through a child's eye.
It's quite possible that, thanks to your graphic novel, young people can enjoy both versions. And there is also the 1962 film adaptation, which could be considered another option for those who find reading difficult. No reason why another generation cannot enjoy this classic.
Absolutely.
Where did you get your inspiration for the illustrations? You mentioned earlier in the interview that you went to Monroeville?
Yes. I based the novel adaptation on sketches I'd made from the buildings and the neighbourhood Harper Lee lived in. Everything about the structure of the town in the book is Monroeville. It was pretty striking. I hadn't realised that her novel is a story of her life as a child.
I consider it incredible that, after all these years, more than a million To Kill a Mockingbird novels are sold around the world each year, and, since its publication, it has been translated into more than 40 languages. And now, according to the publishers, you have made it possible for readers to be able to revisit the book or to discover it for the first time. Final word, Fred?
To Kill a Mockingbird regularly tops polls as our nation's most loved book. Adapting a story that means so much to so many and finding the appropriate style to give it life in a new visual art form was a great honour and responsibility, and also a great pleasure.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good evening. Henry Jones here, welcoming you to our latest edition of the arts radio magazine, Front Row. Tonight, we are going to discuss an unusual event. Two supposedly conflicting art forms joining forces to create something new and exciting. I'm talking about a comic book remake of To Kill a Mockingbird. Since its publication in 1960, Harper Lee's novel has been turned into a stage play, which is performed every year in Lee's hometown, a musical, and most famously an Oscar-winning film in 1962. However, no one thought of adapting the multi-award-winning novel into a comic book until now. A graphic or comic book adaptation is about to be released, and the artist chosen and approved of by Harper Lee's family is a young British illustrator, Fred Foreman. He studied politics and philosophy at Sussex University, where, hoping to earn extra money for his studies, he painted portraits and taught art. He became interested in graphic art and chose to become an illustrator and painter. He has not looked back. Congratulations, Fred. It must have been a mammoth task to draw and adapt the book.
Thanks, Henry. You have no idea how excited I was when I was approached amid a spy novel atmosphere of secrecy to adapt the great work in 2016. I can tell you, it was pretty daunting. To Kill a Mockingbird is considered more than a novel. It's a cultural event. I never thought it would be possible. However, I went on a 10-day trip to Monroeville, Lee's hometown, on which she based the fictional make-home of the book, and saw where she lived. The Lee family were very keen on the idea of a graphic novel, and convinced me that a meaningful adaptation was possible.
You will agree, as will many of our listeners, that To Kill a Mockingbird has been such an important book to us for more than half a century, and the novel has been credited with awakening thousands of teenagers to the rewards of literature. It is amazing to think that this classic portrayal of injustice and innocence in America's Deep South is being brought to a new generation in the form of a graphic novel.
That's right. So instead of devouring Harper Lee's wonderful prose, readers can follow the tale of Scout, Jem, Boo Radley, and Atticus Finch through 260 pages of colourful cartoons and speech bubbles. Although I am aware that this will be fun to read, I have a clear message for all young readers. It's absolutely no substitute for the original.
So you're saying that the new graphic version should not be seen by young readers as a lightweight alternative to reading the full text?
Absolutely not. I read it at school and then at university as part of my degree course. To try and do a graphic or comic adaptation of something solely to make it easier to read is doing a disservice to the original novel. It also does the same to the graphic novel because, in a way, it's treating the comic book as a more childish version. This should be read as well as, not instead of. Pretty much the same way as up until now, you would watch the film as an introduction to the book.
You know, despite the reservations of many in the literary establishment, graphic novels are becoming ever more mainstream. Comic book versions of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Emma have been produced and well received, which proves the medium is growing in popularity with increasing numbers of readers. However, To Kill a Mockingbird must have presented particular challenges.
You're right. There are some very somber and solemn episodes in the book, and you have to accept that. But in so many other ways, it's very easy to read. Bits of it are light and funny. Even the sad parts are seen through a child's eye.
It's quite possible that, thanks to your graphic novel, young people can enjoy both versions. And there is also the 1962 film adaptation, which could be considered another option for those who find reading difficult. No reason why another generation cannot enjoy this classic.
Absolutely.
Where did you get your inspiration for the illustrations? You mentioned earlier in the interview that you went to Monroeville?
Yes. I based the novel adaptation on sketches I'd made from the buildings and the neighbourhood Harper Lee lived in. Everything about the structure of the town in the book is Monroeville. It was pretty striking. I hadn't realised that her novel is a story of her life as a child.
I consider it incredible that after all these years, more than 1 million To Kill a Mockingbird novels are sold around the world each year, and, since its publication, it has been translated into more than 40 languages. And now, according to the publishers, You have made it possible for readers to be able to revisit the book or to discover it for the first time. Final word, Fred?
To Kill a Mockingbird regularly tops polls as our nation's most loved book. Adapting a story that means so much to so many and finding the appropriate style to give it life in a new visual art form was a great honour and responsibility, and also a great pleasure.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. In this part, you will hear an extract from a programme on health and well-being in which psychologists are discussing happiness. For questions 31 to 33 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than three words for each answer. For questions 34 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
In today's programme, two of my colleagues will be answering questions on happiness. The study of happiness is unique in the enormous variety of nonsense and pseudoscience that surrounds it. Fortunately, this has improved in recent years, and among the waffle there are some useful, scientifically proven principles that we can all apply to our lives. I would like to introduce you to two of my colleagues. Firstly, Dr. Dean Burnett, who, as a neuroscientist, studies the human brain. Secondly, Professor Paula Dolan, who is a professor of behavioural science. What does happiness actually mean? Over to you, Dean.
Thank you. Happiness is an umbrella term for all the different ways in which we can feel positive and good, from feeling excited to feeling relaxed. It's your brain's way of encouraging behaviour that it thinks is beneficial to you, such as eating, improving your social standing, or taking part in a group exercise. There are several neurological chemicals and processes involved. For example, one such chemical is called oxytocin, which helps with emotional bonds, and we call it the cuddle molecule. Endorphins are chemicals which are released into the body after sustained effort or stress and give us a feeling of great pleasure. These chemicals in themselves do not cause happiness, as you can't just ingest them and expect to be happier, but are part of a complex system. Think of them as the different materials and processes you need to build a house. In a way, happiness is predetermined, as different people will have different levels of sensitivity. Some people might need a greater sense of adventure to feel positive. You might feel happy watching your favourite football team score a goal, but others might need something more thrilling. To stimulate the feel-good chemicals and processes, you should exercise more, eat better, and so on. Then your body becomes more efficient and better able to support your brain with the conditions it needs for its health and your happiness.
Paula, what kinds of happiness should we prioritise?
Happiness is our experience of pleasure and purpose in our lives, and we need both of them. Pleasurable things are those that make us feel good while we're doing them, like having family time, watching entertaining films, and eating good food. Purposeful experiences are those that involve a delayed sense of achievement, such as grueling exercise, learning something new, or working on a demanding project. Both these things are important, and we need a balance of them.
Thanks, Paula. Dean, we hear a lot about how exercise should make us happy. What kind of exercise is best?
Interval training, in which you alternate between working very hard and resting, tends to be the kind of exercise most recommended for rapid improvement in health. The link between well-being and exercise isn't as clear as some people make out, but anything that improves your general health will also improve your ability to be happy. Exercise in a group tends to be associated with better mental health. Keep giving yourself new challenges because your brain stops responding very quickly to anything that is too familiar.
Thanks, Dean. Paula, how do I know what makes me happy?
We tell ourselves lots of stories about what should make us happy. The job, the house, the family, and so on. What counts is moment-to-moment happiness, not abstract evaluations of our lives. This is something people often lose sight of. For example, people stay in jobs they dislike for reasons such as the job's prestige, or because they hope to earn money to enjoy later. Or they read a book because it's serious, but don't enjoy it. That's not a sensible approach. You can't expect to regain happiness. Lost happiness is lost forever. We are so bad at evaluating our own happiness that it's often more useful to ask friends or family. People who know us well will have a clearer view of what makes us happy from day to day.
Well, I've figured out what makes me happy, but it's hard to change my habits. How do I do it, Dean?
Willpower is finite, and all of us need help forming habits. Don't just set yourself a target like doing more exercise. Break it down into manageable steps. Prime yourself into following them by putting gym trip into your calendar. Involve other people, telling them what your plans are, or asking them to join you in whatever you have planned. Rehearse how you will respond to obstacles. I am tired, but I will go to the gym. I'm having a meal with my family and the phone rings. I'll not answer it.
Thanks, Dean. Paula, are there surefire, easily proven ways to achieve happiness?
Well, humans are happier when surrounded by nature. Even proximity to potted plants has been shown to have this effect. Socialising is good for us, and so is exercise. Laughter has been shown to relax us. Doing things for other people makes us much happier. Finally, pay attention to the activities that make you happy. Distractions such as mobile phones ruin our focus on pleasurable experiences.
Thank you, Paula and Dean. If these two people cannot help you feel happier and more confident in yourself, nobody can. We could continue, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Join us again next week.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
In today's programme, two of my colleagues will be answering questions on happiness. The study of happiness is unique in the enormous variety of nonsense and pseudoscience that surrounds it. Fortunately, this has improved in recent years, and among the waffle there are some useful, scientifically proven principles that we can all apply to our lives. I would like to introduce you to two of my colleagues. Firstly, Dr. Dean Burnett, who, as a neuroscientist, studies the human brain. Secondly, Professor Paula Dolan, who is a professor of behavioural science. What does happiness actually mean? Over to you, Dean.
Thank you. Happiness is an umbrella term for all the different ways in which we can feel positive and good, from feeling excited to feeling relaxed. It's your brain's way of encouraging behaviour that it thinks is beneficial to you, such as eating, improving your social standing, or taking part in a group exercise. There are several neurological chemicals and processes involved. For example, one such chemical is called oxytocin, which helps with emotional bonds, and we call it the cuddle molecule. Endorphins are chemicals which are released into the body after sustained effort or stress, and give us a feeling of great pleasure. These chemicals in themselves do not cause happiness, as you can't just ingest them and expect to be happier, but are part of a complex system. Think of them as the different materials and processes you need to build a house. In a way, happiness is predetermined, as different people will have different levels of sensitivity. Some people might need a greater sense of adventure to feel positive. You might feel happy watching your favourite football team score a goal, but others might need something more thrilling. To stimulate the feel-good chemicals and processes, you should exercise more, eat better, and so on. Then your body becomes more efficient and better able to support your brain with the conditions it needs for its health and your happiness.
Paula, what kinds of happiness should we prioritise?
Happiness is our experience of pleasure and purpose in our lives, and we need both of them. Pleasurable things are those that make us feel good while we're doing them, like having family time, watching entertaining films, and eating good food. Purposeful experiences are those that involve a delayed sense of achievement, such as grueling exercise, learning something new, or working on a demanding project. Both these things are important, and we need a balance of them.
Thanks, Paula. Dean, we hear a lot about how exercise should make us happy. What kind of exercise is best?
Interval training, in which you alternate between working very hard and resting, tends to be the kind of exercise most recommended for rapid improvement in health. The link between well-being and exercise isn't as clear as some people make out, but anything that improves your general health will also improve your ability to be happy. Exercise in a group tends to be associated with better mental health. Keep giving yourself new challenges, because your brain stops responding very quickly to anything that is too familiar.
Thanks, Dean. Paula, how do I know what makes me happy?
We tell ourselves lots of stories about what should make us happy. The job, the house, the family, and so on. What counts is moment-to-moment happiness, not abstract evaluations of our lives. This is something people often lose sight of. For example, people stay in jobs they dislike for reasons such as the job's prestige, or because they hope to earn money to enjoy later. Or they read a book because it's serious, but don't enjoy it. That's not a sensible approach. You can't expect to regain happiness. Lost happiness is lost forever. We are so bad at evaluating our own happiness that it's often more useful to ask friends or family. People who know us well will have a clearer view of what makes us happy from day to day.
Well, I've figured out what makes me happy, but it's hard to change my habits. How do I do it, Dean?
Willpower is finite, and all of us need help forming habits. Don't just set yourself a target like doing more exercise. Break it down into manageable steps. Prime yourself into following them by putting gym trip into your calendar. Involve other people, telling them what your plans are. or asking them to join you in whatever you have planned. Rehearse how you will respond to obstacles. I am tired, but I will go to the gym. I'm having a meal with my family and the phone rings. I'll not answer it.
Thanks, Dean. Paula, are there surefire, easily proven ways to achieve happiness?
Well, humans are happier when surrounded by nature. Even proximity to potted plants has been shown to have this effect. Socializing is good for us, and so is exercise. Laughter has been shown to relax us. Doing things for other people makes us much happier. Finally, pay attention to the activities that make you happy. Distractions such as mobile phones ruin our focus on pleasurable experiences.
Thank you, Paula and Dean. If these two people cannot help you feel happier and more confident in yourself, nobody can. We could continue, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Join us again next week.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.